about considerate.
I'm touched.
She can have my office chair.
She can have my office.
For everyone's good, let's adopt proper habits against the viruses. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Hey there, Xander here. Just popping in with a content warning, we'll be covering some fairly heavy stuff this episode. Today, we'll be talking about Cleansed by Sarah Kane. In discussing the play, we'll be touching upon sexual assault, substance abuse, mutilation, suicide, and bigotry. If that sounds like a bad time, we totally get it, and we'll see you... Well, when we see you, this is the last episode. Welcome again, dear listeners, to episode 4 of The Gory Details, a part of CKUT's Transforming the Airwaves lineup. I'm your NB host, Xander. What's The Gory Details, you ask? Well, it's a show where we aim our pointedly politically queer eye onto a piece of uncomfortable, disarming, and slash or abrasive piece of media. Specifically, its ideas, themes, and most importantly, how its constructed imagery informs, empowers, and detracts from its rhetoric. I'm not alone in the studio, though. Today, I'm joined by actor, playwright, starlet, and performer coming off of her extremely successful performance and production of Sire, a father-daughter vampire story, and hosting the Montreal English Theatre Awards, Dara Mondu. How are you?
I'm not alone. I'm right here with you, Xander. I'll keep you safe.
How are you doing?
I'm doing just wonderful. It's a beautiful winter day here in Montreal, and it's very much my season of darkness.
I'm definitely looking forward to not being outside. Today we are going to be talking about a fairly toasty and spicy production, or script, Sarah Kane's 1998 play Cleansed. Originally performed at the Royal Court Theatre downstairs in London, England, directed by James MacDonald, with Kane herself performing in the role of Grace, the initial actor having to sit out the initial run due to an injury. Audience response, while critically lauded in retrospect, was initially nil due to the lack of turnout. It's relatively unsurprising due to the critical misunderstanding that Blasted posed only a few years before. Blasted being uncritically blasted, I suppose, as an exercise in brutality and what the critical audience would call filth. Interestingly enough, the initial run of Cleansed reported contradicting observations of a small audience. Alex Seitz, in his book In Your Face Theatre, A British Drama Today, describes the small, often gay audience to be appreciative, understanding, and accepting of the player's overt gender confusions, laughing and grappling with the raw emotional performance on stage. Graham Saunders, author of Love Me or Kill Me, Sarah Kane and the Theatre of Extremes, contradicts the descriptions by, I quote, "We regularly got booed, especially towards the end when they saw the sewed-on penis on Grace. I remember one particular time, again right at the end of the performance, and the audience was clapping and someone shouted out, 'Boo, what's it all about?' And I desperately wanted to do was to climb down and to go into the audience and to find him and bring him up on stage and to try to explain the play. And I suppose this is a particularly interesting issue with a lot of more challenging shows, where we have this odd dichotomy with needing to appeal to a mass audience, the idea of presenting unchallenging theater to get, I'm not going to clap, but most people do, butts in seats, which is rather troubling, especially when it comes to experimental theater or theater of cruelty or even Brechtian theater.
I would say that provocative theater makers, people who need an audience because the audience's engagement and the audience's reaction is as much a part of their artistic process as the rehearsal process itself, welcome that kind of negative reaction. They might be really excited by someone who gets up and shouts in the middle of a play. The last professional piece I was able to work on involved a lot of seating my audience down, introducing myself to them head on and engaging with them, giving a large sense of the stakes of a scene, and then asking them to help me decide how I do proceed in the next couple of scenes. So I think more and more theater has to negotiate how it's going to be different from Netflix, how it's going to be different from sitting down at home. And making provocative theater, it is to provoke a reaction. It is excited about troubling people. And while we have now, I think, a great vocabulary around our boundaries and, you know, the content warnings that you graciously put ahead of the discussions of Sarah Kane's Cleansed, there is still an appetite of people who want to go out and feel a disturbance that the day-to-day rigmarole of their daily lives doesn't offer them in a safe and compassionate space.
Exactly. I mean, Sarah Kane is very much an Artaudian. What is Artaudian theater? It is pretty much what one would describe theater of cruelty. Theater of cruelty being a kind of theater based around the forcing the audience to engage with a sense of hyperreality through the implementation of cruel acts, discomfort, sights, smells, sensory overload, in physically engaging and touching the audience in a way. Artaud himself, author of Theater and the Theater's Double, felt that society needed a sharp, quick shock to be awoken from their cathartic, laid-back stance. Whether or not it's actually successful is debatable at times. Your host is more personally a Brechtian, which feels that Artaud actually goes fully the other way around by forcing an engaged, hyper-real state of mind, by engaging in surreal acts of violence. You're going so far beyond that you are forcing the audience to engage in the fictitious elements of theater and to engage with the medium being a part of the message, rather than, how Artaud would put it, to have the stage and the actors disappear and to have the audience remain in the theater alone.
I'm glad to hear you bring up, like, the McLuhan element to this, of course, because it's a nice idea to think about shocking society out of its complacency, but at the end of the day, theater is not mass media, is it? You are dealing with very elect, very specific kinds of people who speak the same language as you, who probably live transportable distances from you. You're dealing with, like, a very small given sample size of society, and what they're doing when they go to see theater, I think, is submitting themselves to an exception from society for a given moment. You're going into a piece of theater, you're putting your worries at the door, you're forgetting your job, and especially if you're being invited to engage and get shaken into the world of a destabilizing, frightening piece of performance art, then you're leaving society behind you, if only to go back to it at the end of the show with a renewed sense of stability and stasis and comfort.
Yes. The play we're discussing is greatly influenced by The Lover's Discourse by Roland Barthes, particularly structured after Rorschach. I'm butchering that name.
I thought it was Wojciech?
Wojciech?
That they taught me in theater school is Wojciech.
Yes, unfortunately, your gracious host was an English major, and thus this piece was omitted from their
Xander
curriculum.
Doesn't speak European, you guys. Go easy.
By Jörg Buchner. It was planned as a now-defunct trilogy, each being a sort of reaction to war. Now, when discussing the play, it's important to stress that there's a bunch of different ways of really viewing the text, one being that of the text itself, reading what could be gleamed off the paper or an LED screen, another being a more complicated dissection of a performance, a mounting of the show, less so of what's to be said, but how it's said. A third, which would be as how one would present the piece, a kind of hybrid of the previous two, what your inner director, actor, or unenviable stage manager and technical director would do in place of the audience members' minds and actions. What's your favorite way to read a play?
I guess there's something really exciting about a first table read, which I do think exists at the exact halfway point between encountering a text off a library shelf and seeing it on stage. The table read is often just done, you know, maybe with actors or producers who are invested in the play, who want to get into it, who want to see it through, who want to help develop it. But often, just as often, are just like a group of friends who are interested in digging into a story and giving it the different voices and perspectives that it's required to, I think, approach its next iteration, approach the next phase, which would be like rehearsal, direction, mounting, designing, and everything else that you're discussing. So my favorite way to read a play would be with a bunch of homies with glasses of wine around a table where we can snicker, we can laugh. There's space to like make jokes or, you know, screw up a line, take it again, and have fun with it, where the stakes are really low. There is no audience that's jeering or hanging on the edge of their seat. There's only your other actors in the room who may not be part of the scene, the other producers, the other writers in the room who are getting so much out of hearing these voices there. That's definitely my favorite way to read a play.
No, definitely. It's the same with me. Personally, I love not only reading the play across from other people. In fact, that's probably one of my favorite pastimes, but also to just kind of talk about and to nerd out about how the meaning of specific lines, so on and so forth. The shameless English major here. So when engaging with this particular text, how did you choose to take in the information?
I was reading it in a cafe with my partner, who we like to just go on work dates together. So, you know, he'll bring his laptop and he'll get some of his work from home stuff done. I'm kind of between gigs right now, so I was there reading away. It felt a lot more like a return to a study buddy kind of library hang in my university days. And certainly being assigned to read a play brought me back to theater school in a really, like, lovely way. This isn't something that I think I would have come across on my own, though I am familiar with Sarah Kane and her biography and her body of work. My partner himself developed an interpretation of this monologue that was part of another play of hers as well. So I had a sense of it going in that it was going to be rough. And before I was even halfway in, I already like sent the document to another friend of mine who also is really into the meta-modern approach to theater, who likes to leave space for what is triggering, what is harrowing, what is physical, what is engaging, what is holding the audience accountable to what they're seeing on stage. And he got so excited as well. He was really like, so I think even though I was sitting there quietly reading this to myself, there was already a sense of engaging with this collectively. There was already a sense of like, I need other artists alongside me and with me. But it is really rough, and it describes a environment, right? It describes this interior walled in university campus space, not unlike the one we find ourselves on now, Xander, where like these horrible kind of treatments are being issued to these patients, I believe, by this megalomaniacal doctor, and that some of them are like voluntarily checked in, some of them are obviously like the victims of a bigoted kind of past, I suppose, DSM-5 like section that would get you kind of institutionalized back then. So it was a very like interior world. It kind of made me quiet, made me sensitive. It made me feel things in my body that were being described in the stage directions. And it's interesting to see that Sarah Kane notes in her author's notes, the playwright's notes, that how, you know, of course, dashes indicate the overlapping of lines, but that stage directions should function as lines. And I found the stage directions much more interesting. Everything in italics in this play, much more interesting than the often fractured, often kind of pieced together, half hazy lines of dialogue that the characters ever speak. So where I mined for meaning, where I went back and read and employed more and more of my imagination of how I would stage this or how this could possibly be rendered on stage, was always in the stage directions.
Yes, actually, it's very interesting that you should bring up the stage directions. I was, in doing my research for this episode, National Theatre Live actually produced a production of Cleanse back in 2016, which I have been desperately trying to get my fingers on, but it is, while they do have it written, they have it cataloged, they did film it, it is not present on their streaming service, on their rental service. They have, I have emailed them, they have not gotten back to me. In regards to if they ever have plans on making this visually accessible. Which...
National Theater, this is a call out, okay?
Oh, yes.
You need to make this... I can completely understand why they're not excited to make this accessible. I can understand why just one ounce of pushback, especially in, like, you know, the last, I would say, like, 5-6 years of the reformations that we've been lucky enough to be alive for, might just make it something they want. They know is sensitive subject matter. They know that it's touchy.
So. It is definitely sensitive, but I would actually say that we're due for another advent of challenging yet progressive work. I would actually say that Cleansed is very much ahead of its time in regards to its presentation of queer struggles, queer pain, and the inherent institutional violence that queer peoples suffer from on a day-to-day. Now,
maybe I'm thinking a bit about, like, the 90s specifically, and, like, I'm thinking about Kids, I'm thinking about Rent, I'm thinking about, like, other instances of queer representation, specifically in drama where it was adapted to film, but also film in its own sense. But I feel like it's a decade of great queer despair. It can be, I think, like, an era where we see a lot of dreadful, unhappy representations of queerness as, like, this tragic state that I do think, you know, as homophobic as the 2000s were, at least the 2010s and everything we've experienced lately has made more space for queer joy and queer celebration and queer nightlife as a sacred space of self-affirmation without the threat, without something terrible happening. I would, like, a friend of mine accurately pointed out when I saw Call Me By Your Name, I was kind of like, huh, super weird that, like, nothing happens in that movie. And he said, I think that's the point. I think what you experience in that movie is the threat, constantly the threat. Every scene leaves you on the edge of, oh no, are they going to be discovered? Is it all going to fall apart? And nothing falls apart, and nothing is violent, and nothing is awful, and everything's okay. Whereas, obviously, this piece of Sarah Kane's writing just shows us that trans bodies and queer bodies are sites of destruction and pain and political social punishment that feels very 90s to me, that I wouldn't call progressive from where I'm standing in 2023, but I'm sure for the time was part of a canon of holding space and making, I guess, a general public more aware of just how abandoned and probably despised and uncared for, I'm sure, like, queer adults were feeling, especially after the AIDS crisis and everything else.
Well, I would actually, and this is something we'll get into more in the free open discussion portion of the show, but I would actually push back slightly about the fact that this play is purely about the fact that trans and queer bodies are that of moments of derision and violence, but more so, the show is about queer temporality. About the calling forward Jill Dolan's performance Utopia. The show is very much about creating these moments, elevating these tender moments between these characters in spite of this violence, in which, regardless of whatever may happen before or whatever may happen afterwards, the performer's actions create a utopia within those small moments. And it's inviting the audience to not necessarily see what should be, but to feel what should be. And I feel like, especially right now with, you know, the slow growing desperate acts of a fascist movement that is constantly, you know, battering on our doors. There's the constant growing conservative movement, the rise of Paul Poilievre, the thankfully slow decline of the right wing in the South. We always have to remain vigilant, and we have to be reminded that these temporary moments are radical acts, regardless. And I feel like this play is even now contemporary to queer moments in of themselves.
That's so beautiful to be reminded of, Sander, because I think in reading this, the moments of violence and the moments of, like, body horror, to me, were so theatrically baffling, like, just to read on stage. So my mind was much more occupied with, like, now how would you make it so that his feet are cut off? How do you train rats to run around on stage to nibble at the stumps where his hands used to be? And it occupied more of my imagination than these warm, tender moments like you're describing, where there are flowers, where there is sentiment, where there is cynicism broken and faith in humanity restored, even in these bleak times. And I think that's something that, like, visually mounting it on stage would privilege more than reading it on paper. So thank you for reminding me of all
those scenes. Oh, definitely. It is. I should actually note that I had the privilege of seeing production of the show very recently, less so live. It is a recording on YouTube, a university recording. It is incredibly hard to find productions of this piece. I would actually argue nigh impossible because of the content that is present, though I would actually, like I said, I would actually argue that we do need more productions of these. Maybe not as, I suppose, violent in some regards, because it might distract from the initial rhetoric. And that is something that is rather important to really talk about. Whether or not the horror elements distract from the rhetoric or is additive. Personally, I feel it's additive. But again, this is something we'll get to the open discussion portion of the show. So Sarah Kane herself was an English playwright born in February 1971, and I find that rather telling as to the sensationalist approach to the personality of the author that her Wikipedia page, yes, I'm that kind of hack, features an entry regarding her depression and eventual suicide that dwarfs the entirety of the word count devoted to her content, all five of her shows, including her life. Though, at the very least, we do have some reasonable biographical treatments, as was provided in her obituary penned by one of her contemporaries, Mark Ravenhill, author of a show that is near and dear to me called Shopping and Fucking, in addition to other pieces. She was raised in Essex to a journalist and a born-again household, and had a virulent rejection of the suburban English cultural value systems by the age of 17, including the religion in which she was raised. A lot of it is actually featured in her work if you are a student of the cruel symbolism that she rather employs. A quote, "There is an attitude that certain things could not happen here. Yet, there's the same amount of abuse and corruption in Essex as everywhere and anywhere else. And that's what I want to blow open." She attended Bristol University, read drama, then moved on to attend David Edgar's course in playwriting at Birmingham. Her work deeply inspired by Edward Bond's Saved, claiming that you can essentially glean everything and anything to know about playwriting as a craft through that play. It was shortly after concluding her education in 1995 that her first show, Blasted, debuted, then Phaedra's Love, then Cleansed, Crave, and finally 448 Psychosis, which was unfortunately presented 2 years after her death. A total of five plays, a short film named Skin, along with a collection of articles for The Guardian. There's numerous narrativizations of her life. One obituary by The Guardian states, "It cost Kane a lot to write Cleansed, and it has taken her many years." Quoting, "There is an enormous amount of depression in the play because I felt an enormous amount of despair when writing it," she said. Another, by The Independent, penned by Mark Ravenhill, simply quotes her from an exchange after reading the play, with her simply stating, "Well, I'm in love." Upon Blasted's release, she'd spend much of her time viewing productions of the piece by other companies, sitting behind the audience, quiet, anonymous. She was also incredibly encouraging to other authors, having read hundreds of scripts in workshops with Bush Theatre as a literary associate. As many reviewers, authors, journalists attempt to tie her into various categories, movements, and waves, such as New Brutalism, she'd often observe such attempts to shell her works into specifics with derision. "When people come to see a Crave," she says, "they will be surprised, or they will find the label does not apply. I am not a New Brutalist." In 1999, Sarah Kane ended her life. She struggled with clinical depression throughout her adulthood. I won't narrativize the experience. There are many pieces regarding the end of her life, and as I've said, the wiki section on her struggle is obnoxiously larger than the sum of all of her work. I'd like to instead point out that Blasted was about hope. Cleansed was about love. Crave abandoned the violence of her previous works, instead focused on obsessive love. 448, her final play, the most challenging, I would suppose, was about meaning. At 448 in the morning, in the dark, when you can find none. She loved working on theater, working in theater, watching theater, and encouraged others to do the same. We open to a university. We also open to an overdose.
Tinker.
I'm cooking.
I want out.
No. Tinker, a dealer, not a doctor, stands apart from Graham. They talk about their friendship. Or, more so, they argue about whether or not they're friends. Tinker inserts heroin into the eye of Graham. We count down from 10. And the show begins. Rod and Carl are next. In a room together, there is a marriage proposal. Rod refuses, though Carl insists and promises that he'll always love him, that he'll never betray him, never lie to him. Please.
No.
I don't expect anything.
Yes, you do.
You don't have to say anything.
I do.
Babe, please, baby.
Fuck's sake.
Rod, sorry, please.
Listen, I'm saying this once. I love you now. I'm with you now. I'll do my best, moment to moment, not to betray you. Now. That's it? No more. Don't make me lie to you.
I'm not lying to you. Despite the verbal struggle, Carl does not relent. Despite the temporality, the hesitation, they kiss at the end of the scene. Tinker watches, unable to intervene. It's in scene 3 that we find Grace. She confronts Tinker about the death of her brother, Graham, of which it's been revealed that the events of the scene takes place 6 months prior. She demands his clothes, of which Tinker describes is recycled.
Isn't that very unhygienic?
He died of an overdose.
Then why burn his body?
He was an addict. She pushes the issue, and Tinker summons a 19-year-old boy, Robin, into the room. He's been given Graham's clothes. He's ordered to strip. She puts on his clothes and breaks down. Tinker forces her onto the bed, injects her, and urges her to leave. She does not.
I'm staying.
You'll be moved.
I look like him. Say you thought I was a man.
I can't protect you.
I don't want you to.
You shouldn't be here. You're not well.
Treat me as a patient.
Show me your tongue. Swallow. Tinker leaves shortly after refusing any kind of responsibility. Robin and Grace talk. She asks him to dress. She asks him to write her to her parents. Robin tells her that a voice tells him to kill himself. Though he's safe here. Nobody wants to die. He can't write, though. We're back to Carl. He's being beaten. His assailants are not visible. Tinker presides. He lifts a hand and the beating stops. there's a vertical passage through your body, a straight line through which an object can pass without immediately killing you. It starts here.
Stage directions read, he touches Carl's anus. Carl stiffens with fear.
Can take a pull. Push it up here, avoiding all major organs until it emerges here.
He touches Carl's right shoulder.
Die eventually, of course. From starvation, if nothing else gets you first. He interrogates Carl. He interrogates Carl while performing the action. He mocks Carl while performing the action. He's forced to beg, in fear and in pain, while Tinker performs the action. Rod, not me, he repeats. Rod, not me. And the pole is removed. Rod falls from a great height, from out of the scene, into the scene, and next to Carl. Tinker removes Carl's tongue, removing the ring from their previous marriage proposition, and forces Carl to swallow. Grace awakes from her slumber to find her long-dead Graham standing above her. They dance together, a dance of love, as described in the stage directions. I feel it's important to quote the stage directions particularly here.
Graham dances a dance of love for Grace. Grace dances opposite him, copying his movements. Gradually, she takes on the masculinity of his movement, his facial expression. Finally, she no longer has to watch him. She mirrors him perfectly as they dance exactly in time. When she speaks, her voice is more like his.
Their dance becomes closer. They sing the first verse of You Are My Sunshine, and they kiss. They make love. In doing so, a sunflower grows from the floor. Graham pulls it towards him and smells it. Lovely, he says. We're back to Tinker now. He's viewing a sex worker in a box. She dances. He's touching himself. Don't dance, I... Can I see your face?
The woman stops dancing and considers, and after a moment she sits. Tinker doesn't look at her. The woman waits.
What are you doing here?
I like it.
It's not right.
I know.
Can we be friends? He tells her he's a doctor, that he can help her. He calls her Grace. Grace is attempting to help Robin learn to read. He asks her about whom she once loved. She says Graham. Robin and Graham speak in unison, asking about her boyfriend. She says Paul. They ask her if she would change anything about her life. What would she change? Robin asks if she believes in heaven. Robin asks, or suggests, that he'd revive Graham.
Graham's not a thing to change, and he's not in your life.
He is.
How?
They gave me his clothes. Tinker is watching them. They ask her again. What would you change?
My body. So it looked like it feels... Graham outside, like Graham inside.
Robin tells her he loves her. He'd marry her. Tinker enters and takes a paper that Robin was working on. He's drawn a flower. Tinker burns it. Robin, however, remarks that she smells like a flower. Rod and Carl are together again. Carl is unable to speak. He remarks that Carl would allow them to crucify him. To harm him, to allow rats to eat his face. He forgives him, however. He's young. Don't blame yourself, he says. No one's to blame. Carl writes a thing while Tinker watches. He waits for Carl to finish before removing his hands. He leaves. Rod goes to Carl, though, and puts on his ring. He won't lie to Carl. He asks for forgiveness. Tinker sees the woman in the box again. He promises that he'd save her. He calls her Grace again. In another room, Grace is being beaten by a group of unseen men. Graham watches, unable to help. They taunt her and eventually sexually assault her. Graham bleeds where she bleeds. He attempts to shield Grace from the events by covering her eyes. However, somehow, despite an even growing escalation of violence accumulating in a hail of gunfire, Grace persists. Again, flowers grow from the ground. Graham smells one and says, "Lovely," as before. Robin sits in the room where Tinker was. He sees the woman in the box. He cries. Grace is sitting in a small beam of light. She claims her testicles hurt. Tinker administers electroshock therapy. Rod and Carl sit in a room together. Rats surround them.
"If you'd have said me, I wonder what would have happened. If he'd said you or Rod, and you'd said me, I wonder if he would have killed you. If he ever asks me, I'll say me. Do it to me, not to Carl, not my lover, not my friend. Do it to me. I'd be gone, first boat out of here. Death isn't the worst thing they can do to you. Tinker made a man bite off another man's testicles. Can take away your life, but not give you death instead."
A child sings off stage. "Things We Said Today" by Lennon and McCartney. Carl and Rod sing. Carl dances. A dance of love for Rod. Again, we'll read the stage directions as stated.
"He begins to dance, a dance of love for Rod. The dance becomes frenzied, frantic, and Carl makes grunting noises mingling with the child singing. The dance loses rhythm. Carl jerks and lurches out of time, his feet sticking in the mud, a spasmodic dance of desperate regret. Tinker is watching. He forces Carl to the ground and cuts off his feet. He's gone. Rod laughs. The rats carry Carl's feet away. The child sings."
Tinker again sees the woman in the box. "Open your legs."
"I'm confused."
"Open your fucking legs. Look. Touch. Touch, fucking touch.
Don't do this.
You want me to help?" He insists that she's a woman. She asks him, as a doctor, that he can help her. "I love you," she says. The scene concludes with him saying, if I'd known, I've always known." Robin is asleep amongst a pile of books, papers, and an abacus. There's a pencil in one hand and a box of chocolates next to his head. Tinker enters and stands next to him. He puts a knife to his throat. He asks if he'd fuck her. He'd asked him where he got the chocolates. Robin got them for Grace. He forces him to eat them, one by one, tossing each piece, forcing the audience to wait till the box is completely empty. Robin wets himself, and while misgendering him, Tinker rubs his face in urine. Grace is tranquilized, vacant after the electroshock. Rod and Carl are outside. They share a tender moment, lamenting on their short time together.
"There's only now,"
he cries. Carl hugs him.
"That's all there's ever been."
Carl kisses him. He makes love to Rod.
"I will always love you. I will never lie to you. I will never betray you on my life."
Rod removes his ring and places it into his mouth. He swallows. He cries. Tinker watches and forces Rod to choose between the two. Rod, true to his word, chooses himself, and his throat is slit. Carl struggles to get to Rod, but gets there in time. He holds Rod as he passes. Tinker orders his body burnt. Robin is working on the length of time he's to remain in the university. He struggles to count, but vocalizes to a vacant Grace. He struggles to get her attention, calling her name. He makes a noose and, after some silence, calls her name again, repeatedly. Tinker watches. The chair is pulled from under Robin, seen force. Graham, ever present, pulls down on Robin, ending his suffering. Tinker leads Grace off stage as Graham sits motionless under Robin. We'll read the stage directions as intended.
Grace lies unconscious on a bed. She is naked, apart from a tight strapping around her groin and chest and blood where her breasts should be. Carl lies unconscious next to her. He is naked, apart from a bloodied bandage strapped around his groin. Tinker stands between them. Tinker undoes Grace's bandage and looks at her groin.
He takes her to a mirror. Grace and Graham are acting in unison. They said they felt everything. Tinker said he's not really a doctor. He moves to fuck the woman in the box next. He calls her Grace. He says he loves her. The show concludes with Carl and Grace sitting next to each other. Grace now looks and sounds exactly like Graham. He's wearing his clothes. Carl is wearing Robin's clothes. That is, what he's been wearing this entire time, Grace's clothes. There is a monologue. I won't read it in its entirety. You should, if you can. Even better, if you can see the show, the mounting of the play, or read it online. Starting with the words, perfect body. It's about the immediacy of sensation, feeling love, the temporality and temporary nature of love, how delicate it is. It's a poignant piece, and really something I'd like to hold over your head, dear listener. Graham asks for help, and Carl holds him. They stare into the sky. The sky burns bright, and the rats squeak louder and louder until the light sound is deafening. And finally, in that moment of reprise, blackout.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
And we're back with the open discussion of our show. We are joined again by Dara Mondu. And so how did it feel going through this synopsis?
To sum up the action, like the plot beats, such as they are in this play, is not at all to do it justice, right? Like, what you get when you read this play, and certainly what I can only imagine you get after watching this play, is these, like, long, drawn-out scenes of great torture, great agony, and great yearning, and great love, almost in equal measure. I did not know before your show that Sarah Kane herself had to step into the role of Grace, and that does just really ignite the imagination, doesn't it?
That was definitely, from what I've gathered from my research, was a moment of joy for her to actually embody the character.
I gotta say, I do feel validated in my observation that this is a play that holds a lot of queer despair specifically, because I remember you quoted Sarah Kane talking about like her mental state when she wrote it, and that she was in this place of despair, and that the thing about despair is like there's no way out but through, and at the bottom of this empty glass of meaningless agony is often the enduring yearning for love and connection, and that I can see. And I appreciate that you selected excerpts of this script that I think speak to that speak to privileging exactly like what we were talking about, the yearning for love, the promise of love, the love that you cannot ever prove in a moment but can only like live up to and embody when things are brutal.
And it's rather important to say that Tinker does seemingly have difficulty in the stage directions intruding upon these tender moments, as if the utopia created creates this protective shield around these performers.
Yeah, that is a beautiful thing that to notice about specifically those scenes that happen beside the garden wall, that happen against the backdrop of a space that is connected to the outer world, that is often intruded upon by the sound of a cricket match, the sound of a child singing, that there is this like great wide world beyond the confines of their misery, of their imprisonment, of the abuses that they're being subjected to at the hands of Tinker, who I suppose is trying to correct and like heal in his own way. Like, if I were to play that character, I would go in being like, I am doing something corrective. This is a social service that I am rendering these maniacs that desperately need me. He does try to give Grace what he thinks she wants, and he tries to seek what he wants out of Grace in somebody else without making that her problem. So he's a very interesting character, kind of like zero in on as like force of society, of like force of social control, but also just as much of a maniac as anyone else in this story.
I'm glad that you brought up Tinker. The way I kind of read him is this very odd contradiction in of himself, the same way an institution functions, how various different personalities, be they bureaucratic, professional, or medical, kind of have their own different ways of, you know, being corrective. The imposition of institutional violence, the imposition of institutional control. I believe that Tinker, despite him performing medical procedures, constantly affirming that he's not a doctor, very much represents, we're being asked to really think of this character as not simply a singular individual who thinks that he is doing right, but he is the pharmaceutical desk clerk who's reading through your, in the context of England, the NHS forms that you'd have to fill out in Canadian terms to make sure that you have the proper medical card, and then to make you wait 9 months to get a singular appointment with a medical professional. He is very much not only that, but I also find that he kind of embodies this Foucauldian epitome of various different stages of institutional intellectualism, in which each stage in history obviously has this idea of the be-all, end-all in regards to knowledge, i.e. The representation of transgenderism as represented as mental illness in previous DSM iterations, or homosexuality being represented as the same back then. I feel that, in a sense, Tinker providing, even at the very beginning of the play, Tinker providing Graham with that initial OD is, one, the inciting action of Grace's journey into Graham, but also, I would imagine, a kind of implication of how medical science had previously leaned into these miracle drugs. And even now, I would actually say that we see reverberations of that with the current opioid crisis as well. This unfettered refusal to allow the care that is required through institutional control, through our arrogance and hubris as a society. We live in a society.
Whereas, like, I find the thing about Tinker, too, like, it's too easy to just call him a representation of the institution because he's given such drives and such idiosyncrasies of his own, such, like, space to explore his attraction to the other characters of the spaces, his own psychosis around it. And he's, like, the name that Sarah Kane gives him is a word that in Britain specifically is like a kind of like a politically incorrect term for this nomadic group of people that still, like, you know, find themselves around different parts of Ireland and Wales.
Really?
As well. Yeah, they would be called like the Tinkers, but now more often you'd hear them called the Travelers. They are nomadic.
Okay.
People that, you know, you might describe as like on the fringes of society, not participating in traditional, settled, bureaucratic, stately ways of living, the way most of England has now been settled into, right?
So I actually just associated the name Tinker as to somebody who tinkers with contraptions and so on and so forth.
It could be that because, I mean, there is like the way that I think he treats the patients kind of mechanically. Grace's administered electric shocks and like the punishments delivered to Carl's body are very like Hammurabian. Like it's all very...
it's very systemic.
Yeah.
It's very mechanical, as you've mentioned. And I feel like that, again, supports the idea that either he is a representation of the institution, but also just simply an arm of the institution.
Which is also to say that the institution itself is never like an objective, stand apart in human force. These are structures, and I think Foucault would say, that betray social values, that mm-hmm. are hang-ups of a repressed... like self-hating kind of culture that, you know, Britain knows best. So,
yeah, no, this is such a fantastic piece and such, while horrifying, I still really think that there's a lot of contemporary work that can be done bringing this forward. I feel that while I do agree with you, the violence can be seen as a distracting element, I feel that it also can be, in the right hands, of course, mm-hmm. can be such an effective tool.
And it can be, I don't know, fun. Horror can be fun. Horror can be campy. Horror can be cathartic. Horror can be horny. There's lots of ways to approach, I think, the violence of this piece in, like, very newly interpreted ways. I was just at a table read recently for a new piece that Micaela de Cesare is working on. And there were instances of a trans character in the piece that she's working on where just, like, a history of some conflict was recounted. And someone else in the room was just remarking on, like, I don't know if we need this trans trauma in this piece. I don't know if we need any more queer trauma in this piece of theater. And that struck me just being like, it's true that it's often just like mined for pathos. It is staged for a shorthand. I think it's important to kind of make sure this history is known, that this history is told, that people's truths can be made space for on stage so that we can reconcile, we can heal, we can grow. And like I've iterated before, like the nice thing about horror, especially in theater, is that it is a safe space. Like you're dealing with compassionate people. If they're trying to shake something out of you, they're not trying to harm you. So these are safe spaces to go and engage with like the dark parts of your own psychosis. And if it brings something painful out of you, you're in good hands to make the creators aware and have them receive. They just want to explain their own perspective of the art to you.
Of course.
That being said, yeah, there's a lot of different ways that you can interpret, I think, the violence of this show in ways that are spectacular.
There are, definitely. And there is a quote that I'll revisit from last episode. Author LaRocca, Eric LaRocca, who we talked about his short story, Things Have Gotten Worse Since We've Last Spoke, who describes his engagement with horror as a way to reconcile your fears in a safe space. And I feel like, in a way, Sarah Kane is giving us these tools to reconcile that moment in time, as well as the queer history of trauma, as well as queer love in that safe space. And while we do have to question, you know, do we need more trans trauma? And that is definitely a worthy question. I personally feel like, in a sense, we need to experiment with not only the horror of trans trauma and history, but the transformative elements of horror when it comes to the trans experience. It is through this arduous path that Grace has become Graham, therefore her true self, the incestuous relationship between herself and Graham during the show could be seen as a history between the two. One could also argue that Graham and Grace's love scene together is more simply her coming to terms with her true self.
That is how I interpreted it personally. Like, there is something very, like, body horror about, like, beautiful romantic incest on stage. Like, I get the appeal. But if we're going to accept Grace's transition into what remains of her lost brother as an earnest exploration of her own masculinity, of her own, like, true gender identity, then I think that scene and its flowers, its eruptions of this joyful, cathartic beauty is more of, like, a harmonizing of the of a union of psychologies, of a pursuit of a new identity.
Yes. And I would actually even go as go forward as to state that the OD of Graham at the very beginning is pretty much the initial medicalizing of Grace's initial sense of body dysmorphia. Of course, when pre-egg, pre-hatching, pre-self-actualization, with especially many of us who grew up in the 90s, 80s or so on, and even in the early 2000s, we're often told to disregard these identities. We're often told that, oh, these are phases, these are mental illnesses that we have to do, that we have to deal with. We're given pills and so on and so forth to mismedicate these prescriptive ideas. But in reality, it is a messy instance of self-actualizing that allows us to push forward. And in a way, understanding and experiencing this pain again is, yes, a kind of trans trauma, but also a celebration of our success despite the pain, despite the horrific institutional violence, microaggressions, being misgendered, and so on and so forth. And witnessing the harm being done is less so, I would argue, a witnessing of that societal pain, but also an affirmation and recognition of those who suffered and fought alongside us. And that should not be forgotten. So that's Cleansed. I'd like to thank Dara for being an excellent guest. Would you like to shout anything out?
For those of you in Montreal interested in coming out to anything I've got going on, you can find me on Instagram at Votre, V-O-T-R-E, dot damn, D-A-M-E. And yeah, I'm just really grateful that you had me on the show and assigned me such reading. Xander, I'm really very grateful.
I'm grateful that you took to the text as much as I did. I'd also like to thank Transforming the Airwaves, CKUT, and Black Casper for making this short series possible. Jack, for their fantastic work on editing each episode, and Madeline for facilitating the process as well. So, what can be said about Cleansed? How do we close that out? I felt that the piece would have to either open this limited-run series or close it, and the reason for that is because of its relationship with queer temporality. In its literal sense, its take on utopic love. All love is fleeting, but queer love in particular is a flame that flickers brightest because of its surrounding windstorm. Amidst legislative violence, institutionalized medical control, gatekeeping, and presiding threat of an ever-growing desperation of an impending fascistic movement, love is by all means a radical act. It sustains us, nurtures us, engenders us for what comes next. Cleansed is a story of queer love in the most desperate of times, and despite that, the most beautiful moments exist regardless of the harm that may come before or after. There's this moment in a lifespan of a play that I find. This liminal moment where you're the last person on stage in a given production. The stage is stricken, taken down, removed, everything is loaded out. I personally like to take a moment despite the emptiness, despite the fact that we don't necessarily belong there anymore, on this empty stage. Because once the stage is gone, once the set is gone, once the actors moved on, the audience gets in their cars, walk home, metros, buses, it's as if the show never happened at all. For that fleeting moment, once you leave the stage for the last time, it's experiencing a definitive end. Sure, you can remount it. Others can too. But that instance, that singular instance of art, uttered lines, performance notes, quips, and comments from the green room, the carefully monitored cues of the frazzled calls, 5 minutes, 1 minute, places. Despite the inexistence that faces the inevitable, the play happens, and love happens. Love will always happen. Cleansed is about that love. And despite whatever end may come, no matter how violent and how monstrous, how melancholic, and regardless of its end, it has happened. Queer love, despite everything, has and will happen again. No matter the kettling, the riot shields, the Molotovs, no matter how many bricks that we need to throw, it has happened. And nothing can take that away from you. This is Xander, signing off. And remember, queer struggle is class struggle.
CKUT, Henry Grimes. And stay tuned for more of the most aesthetic things, feelings in the world.
What's up, what's up, what's up, good people? To those of you listening wherever, whenever, whatever time it is, good morning, good evening, and good night. You are locked into another Tuesday evening with Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Soul P has been on the air since 1994. We bring you all the topics, the guests, the ups and downs, the highs and the lows of the black community here in Montreal, across Canada, and internationally. I'm your host for the evening, Kim Dominique Ferguson, and we have a beautiful evening of music and discussion lined up for you tonight. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial.
You'll recognize I'm not that special. I'm broke inside, crashing slowly. The bugs are in me.